This morning I'm going to deal with an historical subject, a phase of the history of the Reformation, dealing with the comparisons between Erasmus and Luther, two rival reformers. I'm interested in the subject partly because that age, like our age, was an age of revolution, and revolutions can learn from revolutions. Lenin, incidentally, studied the whole history of revolutions as a guide to his own methodology. There are the two questions involved. One is the method of strategy, violent and nonviolent. Erasmus and Luther both deprecated violence of deed, but Luther was rather violent in word, and Erasmus was fearful that this would lead to violence of deed. And as a matter of fact, it did. And then there is the question of the issues involved, the different types of reform in the 16th century. And that has some bearing upon the contemporary issues between Protestantism and Catholicism. One needs to bear in mind at the outset that the confrontation of the two was by no means so clear-cut and acute as it subsequently became. In the early years of the 16th century, there were a good many varieties of reform. I would suggest at least four, two on the Catholic side and two on what came to be the Protestant side. On the Catholic side, a liberal, latitudinarian, tolerant, maybe ethical type of reform, also with a deep piety. Erasmus is its chief exponent. And on the other side, a rigoristic, dogmatic, puritanic, and intolerant variety which triumphed at the Council of Trent and suppressed the earlier liberal Catholic reform. And on the Protestant side, we have the major movements of Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, Cranmer. Here we have the establishment of churches allied with the state. And then alongside of all this, we have a radical fringe with less organization. The chiefly organized groups were the Anabaptists, and from these groups we have the survival of the Mennonites and the Amish and the Hutterites. They would have nothing to do with an affiliation with the state. They advocated religious liberty, separation of church and state, and the voluntary church based upon an adult profession of faith. Then there were rationalists and mystics without any particular immediate following. The whole age was one of a very intense ferment. Now, one curious element in the picture is that in some respects, the lines run from the liberal Catholic reform to the radical Protestant reform. As we go along, we'll see that certain ideas of Erasmus go into Zwingli and the Anabaptists and the Puritans and even the Quakers. So it's not just a pattern like this, but it's this way, and the whole situation as complicated as our own. We were hearing this morning about the crisis in our own day with regard to a basis of authority. Well, that was one of their big problems, too. On the Catholic side, there were debates about the authority of the Pope. The Pope did not yet know infallibly that he was infallible. That wasn't settled until 1870. There were debates about the authority of the Pope, about the authority of the councils, authority of the tradition. The Catholics were debating. The Protestants set up the authority of the Bible, but then they got into all kinds of debates as to what in the Bible. And Lutherans, Zwingli, and the rest were all debating biblical matters. This, too, was a crisis of authority. Now, one difference between that age and our age is that the reformers in that period all looked to the past. Today, the great cry is for something new, and we're looking to the future. They were in rebellion against the immediate past because they wanted to go to a more remote past. There were some of them who envisaged the reform of society in terms of the revival of classical antiquity, the political theory of a Plato and Aristotle. There were those on the Christian side who wanted to reform the church by going back to the Church of the New Testament or the Church of the Apostles, or some would include the Old Testament. In any case, this was to be a great age of revival, of a lost radiance and a lost purity. Then, of course, they began to debate as to what out of all of this they wanted to emphasize. Erasmus desired to combine both the classical and the Christian, and to reform society and the church. But he was not much interested in the Jewish. He didn't like the Old Testament. He didn't like the wars of the Lord and the extermination of the Canaanites and the rest of it. He said you could justify that only if you allegorized it and said it meant the war against the vices. It was mainly the classical and the Christian world which he wanted to revive. That's different from Luther, who was steeped in the Old Testament and actually wrote more about the Old Testament than he did about the New. The method of Erasmus was to be the method of education. He wanted to be an educator of educators and to provide them with the materials from classical antiquity, and that meant that he spent most of his life editing works in Latin and in Greek and providing materials for translations in all of the languages. He wrote only in Latin. It was the universal language of that period. The great tool was the printing press, and no man worked more feverishly to take advantage of the technology of his age than did Erasmus. He was everlastingly running up and down Europe trying to find libraries, manuscripts, editors, and printers. He said if Ulysses was the wisest man in Greece because he visited so many cities, my horse is the wisest in Europe because he has attended so many universities. And when he was reproached for running around so much, he said, well, if the Apostle Paul had stayed in Tarsus, how could he have converted the Roman Empire? Here then is a man, a peripatetic, an everlasting traveler, engaged in the recovery of lost materials, which he believes will contribute to the rejuvenation and purification of his generation, both in society and in the church. There's debate as to when he was born, 1466 or 69, and the matter is of crucial importance in determining when to have the celebration. And the Swiss settled for 66 and they had theirs, and the Dutch for 69 and they're having theirs now. But there's no doubt that he was born in Holland. He's called Erasmus of Rotterdam. He was the illegitimate son of a priest. And there was an older brother. The father was not irresponsible. He acknowledged the boys and provided some money for them, but he could not bring them up. And that task fell to the mother, and she sent him to school in Holland at Deventer, a great center of the Brethren of the Common Life. Now, the Brethren were a new kind of monasticism. They took, at the outset, no lifelong vows. Members could come in and stay and go according to will. They were engaged in devotional exercises, manual labor, but above all else in teaching, and often they planted their members in schools outside of their own community. The great work which emanated from this group is The Imitation of Christ by Thomas Aquinas. And there, I think, there are three notes. We'll find they run through Erasmus again. One is a lyrical piety toward Jesus. There are rhapsodic passages that sound much like St. Francis. And then there is an emphasis on the imitation of Christ, the following in his steps, particularly the way of suffering. And there is an aversion to overly refined theological speculation. The Trinity is better pleased by adoration than by speculation. And one of the brethren inquired as to the theology of the penitent thief. Christ said to him, this day shalt thou be with me in paradise. Well, he hadn't been baptized, he hadn't had the Lord's Supper, he didn't know anything about transubstantiation and consubstantiation and homoousios. But how little theology it takes to get you to heaven. Well, that penitent thief minimal theology note is one that turns up repeatedly in Erasmus. A warm Jesus piety, an imitation of his way of suffering, and contentment with a few rather simple theological affirmations. The brethren were not averse to the study of classical literature, at least many of them were not, for they found in the moral writers of antiquity much which fitted in with Christianity. And Erasmus very early became enthusiastic with regard to both the Christian and the classical heritage. Well, when he was 16, the problem was what next? His parents had died, apparently in the plague. When he was 12, the money left by the father had been exhausted. The guardian wanted to make Erasmus and his brother into monks. They already had literary tastes, and what was more appropriate than the monastic life? The boy stoutly resisted taking the vows. Well, now I should throw in the point that the brethren of the common life in the course of their history had had a division. And one branch, under pressure from others on the other orders, had adopted lifelong vows. And one was still free. Now Erasmus was being pressed to join the branch with the vows, and he resisted. In the end, he gave in. Why? Later on, he regretted he had not joined the order without vows. The reason probably was that he had lived for 2 years in a house of that order, and in that particular house, there was no one who shared his enthusiasms. But the branch with the vows had a magnificent library. Luther became a monk to save his soul, and Erasmus to have access to a fine collection of books. He took the vows. He was with the brothers for 6 years. There were no fundamental rifts. There were some tilts, but they made him a priest. And in after years, when released from the duty of residence, whenever he was in the area, he went back to visit them. But the prior felt that he was restless and that he might be happier if he were secretary to a bishop and got him such a position, but the bishop didn't really need him. He was generous. He provided a stipend which would enable Erasmus to go to the University of Paris, a great ambition. Here he was a candidate for the Doctor of Theology, and of course he had to study theology. With regard to the theologians of that period, he said that they reminded him of a character in Greek legend, Epimenides, who went to sleep for 37 years, except that he did wake up. Now the questions which they were debating alienated Erasmus. One of them was this: if God had so chosen, could he have become incarnate, not in the man Christ Jesus, but in a donkey or a pumpkin? Oh, that, Erasmus would say to a question like that. But his objection was not simply to this silly way of phrasing the matter, but to the idea which lay back of it, because it was one of a whole series of questions, and they all arose out of the doctrine of the omnipotence of God. If God is omnipotent, if he can do anything, if he can do absolutely anything, can he make right wrong? Can he make true false? Can he make black white? Can he cause the past not to have been the past so that a harlot could be called a virgin? Could he do something preposterous, such as to become incarnate in a donkey or a pumpkin? Erasmus felt that absolute power would corrupt even God. There must be certain self-imposed limitations upon the unlimited power of God, or else the whole Christian ethic is undercut. Let God be good. Now that comes up again in subsequent discussion. After 6 years, he had not yet taken his degree. The bishop thought he was becoming a professional graduate student and cut him off. And he had to do what others have had to do, and he earned a little money, and so he began tutoring boys. Nothing better ever happened to him because it compelled him to start writing those educational manuals which later on were to become the textbooks in the schools of Europe and of the American colonies well down into the 18th century. He wrote them in Latin, of course. Many of them were to be translated. Another great advantage of this teaching was that he met students, formed friendships. Among them, the friendship of a young Englishman, Lord Mountjoy, who invited him to go to England and to stay for a time at his country estate. In the summer of 1499, they crossed the Channel, and then they went to the south of England to the estate of this English lord. We have the first letter which Erasmus wrote back to a friend in Paris. He said, "You would hardly know your Erasmus. You should see him now in the chase, and what a courtier he has become. And if you knew the sweetness of the kisses of these English nymphs, you would fly over the Channel like Daedalus, even if you had to doubt." Well, now, some have raised a question as to whether this young monk and priest was demeaning himself according to the principles of his profession. But there are two points to remember. One is, the kissing between the sexes on meeting was a custom in England, but not in France. We have that on independent testimony. The other point is that Erasmus always had an amazing capacity for adapting himself to the taste of his cross-border. And his letters are often more revealing of those to whom he writes than of himself. Now, the man to whom he was writing was an Italian, Fausto Ambrogini, who had gone to Paris, become a French citizen and more French than the French, was teaching literature at the University of the Sorbonne, and had written a volume of amatory verse. We have five or six of his little books in the library. He was a good deal of a gay lady. We'll meet him again. But Erasmus certainly did not stay long enjoying the English nymphs. We find him very speedily at Oxford, working very strenuously on his studies and staying in the house of the Brethren of the Common Light at Oxford. And there he met a very remarkable group of young men. I'll mention only two, John Colet, who later became the Dean of St. Paul's, and Thomas More, later to be Sir Thomas and St. Thomas. The meeting with these young men had a profound effect upon him in various ways. One was in increasing his own self-esteem. This illegitimate son of a priest, this poor lad, dependent on the bounty of his friends, was received by a group of men with ancestry, substance, wit, wealth, wisdom, and social standing, with deference because of his own learning and charm. But there was a lot more than that. He sensed that these men, into whose laps fortune had poured all of her gifts, were ready to throw it all away for their convictions, as later they demonstrated, and already he could feel. But they taught him some other things. One was that he must learn Greek. Thomas More made a good beginning. Colet wished he had. And there were five or six young Englishmen who had already begun. For if he was to interpret the ancient world and early Christianity to his generation, he couldn't do it on the basis of Latin. Plato, Aristotle, Galen, Ptolemy, Plutarch were all in Greek. The New Testament was in Greek. The early fathers were largely in Greek. He got to learn Greek. And he resolved he would set himself to that for the next few years. The next point was that they acquainted him with the revival of Platonic mysticism in Florence. Most of these men had been in Italy. Thomas More hadn't, but he learned Italian. And this school, called the Florentine Academy of Neoplatonism, was having a very considerable vogue. It affected Erasmus at only a few points, but very significant points. And one was the Platonic distinction between the body and the spirit. Now we have that distinction in the New Testament, the flesh and the spirit. But with the Apostle Paul, the flesh is not the physical component of man. It is whatsoever wars against the spirit, so that envy, anger, pride, These are all flesh for Paul, but they're not corporeal. But in the Platonic tradition, the body is regarded as the tomb, or at any rate, the prison of the soul. And in Neoplatonism, religion consists in emancipating oneself from all the things of the senses, so that rising above them in ecstasy, one is lost in union with the ineffable. Now, if you combine that with Christianity, and it had already been done to a degree, but now more markedly, there will be a tendency to disparage all of the external physical aids to religion. Art, physical, comes through the eye. Music, through the ear. Sacrament, through the mouth. And such rites as pilgrimages, cult of relics, and so on, these are essentially physical. Now, this could easily be combined up with the teaching of the Brethren of the Common Life, that it is the inward that is more important than the outward, and the fervent more important than the formal. If you put all this together, that the spiritual is more important than the physical, then you may have a denuding of Christianity of these external aims. Now, this is what passes from Erasmus into Zwingli, who gave up all the organs. He himself could perform on 6 instruments, but he said, not to the glory of God. The function of music is to put the children to sleep. And they took out all of the images and gave up stained glass and so on. And interpreted the sacrament as merely a memorial of Christ's death. And eventually Quakers gave it up altogether. So this line runs through Erasmus, Zwingli, Anabaptists, English Puritans, even to the Quakers. And that, I think, is one reason why Luther felt that Zwingli had a different spirit. For Luther appreciated all of the external aids and said that spirit and flesh are not associated in life. And you can't equate religion with spirit and rule out the flesh. Erasmus then came under these new influences. Then after 5 months, he went back to Paris for a while, and then to his native Holland. And then he brought out a little book, which was to have a very great vogue, called The Dagger of the Christian Soldier, a little manual of Christian piety, in which he inveighs against externalism, against the physical in religion. I'll read you just the conclusion. Do you think you will move God by the blood of a bull or by incense? The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. You venerate the wood of the cross and have no regard for the mystery of the cross. You fast, refraining from that which does not defile, but you do not refrain from obscene conversation. You adorn a temple of stone, but of what use is this if the temple of the heart is full of abominations? With the mouth you bless, with the heart you curse. You enclose your body in a cell, while your mind wanders over the earth. Creep not upon the earth, my brother, like an animal. Put on those wings which Plato says are caused to grow on the soul by the ardor of love. Rise above the body to the spirit, from the visible to the invisible, from the letter to the mystical meaning, from the sensible to the intelligible, from the involved to the simple. Rise as by rungs until you scale the ladder of Jacob. As you draw nigh to the Lord, he will draw nigh unto you. If with all your might you strive to rise above the cloud and the clamor of the senses, he will descend from light inaccessible and that silence which passes understanding, in which not only the tumult of the senses is still, but the images of all intelligible things keep silence. That is the Neoplatonic ecstasy, the rapture, the rising above all the things of sense, until one is lost in the mystical vision. This then was the piety of Erasmus in this early period. Shortly, he had a chance to go back to England again, and from England a chance to go to Italy. For the physician of King Henry VII, Dr. Boenio, was an Italian. He had 2 boys, and he wanted them to be trained at Bologna. And he was willing to pay the expenses of Erasmus
to go with them to Bologna and supervise their studies. They started out, and when they arrived in Italy on their way to Bologna, they heard that Bologna was being besieged by the army of the Pope. Pope Julius II, Giuliano il Secondo, Julius the Terrible, Giuliano il Terribile, a mighty prince of the Renaissance was he. He discovered Bramante and Raffaele and Michelangelo. It was he who took down the old St. Peter's and started the present Basilica, a great patron of arts and letters, the man who drove Michelangelo with the agony and the ecstasy. But all of that takes money. Now, the finances of the papacy in the Middle Ages had very largely come from the estates of the church. The church was actually the ruler, the civil ruler, of a section of Italy. Beginning in Rome, running over the Apennines to the other side, and ending up at Ravenna. This was called the Patrimonium St. Peter, the Patrimonium Sancti Petri, and all the taxes came in from it to the papacy. But now various Italian cities were chipping off a little bit. Bologna, Ferrara, Venice were encroaching upon the Patrimonium of St. Peter. Julius II, in armor, at the head of his own troops, resolved that he would recover the patrimony and restore the finances of the papacy. He besieged Bologna. Word came that the city had fallen. Erasmus and the boys continued their journey and arrived just in time to see the triumphal procession of the Pope, led by the white palfreys, by the representatives of church and state, by all the leaders of the Curia, the Pope himself carried aloft by his soldiers to the church to thank the Lord Jesus for this glorious victory. I viewed it, said Erasmus, magno cum gemito, with a deep sigh. Pope Julius playing Julius Caesar. And he went out to the countryside and saw the papal collectors already exploiting the peasants. When his year was up with the boys, he was released from that obligation and he found money from some source to go and spend a year in Venice. Well, now Venice was the greatest center of printing in Italy. This was the press of Albus Minucius, who had a household of 33 all talking Greek. And they were the exiled Greeks from Constantinople after the fall. And many of them come and settled in Italy. And now they were busy with Greek manuscripts, digging them out, transcribing them, turning them over to the printing presses. And these were being brought out in magnificent editions for European scholars. We have quite a number of them in the library at Yale, beautiful productions. Erasmus became a member of the household of Albus, lived with the others, talked Greek with them, and roomed with the most charming young man, Jerome Alejandro. He was only 23. He knew, of course, Italian and Latin and Greek, but also Arabic and Syriac and Hebrew, and a very charming person. Erasmus was almost as attracted to him as he had been to Thomas More, and will be him again. Erasmus himself brought out some of his own publications while he was there, but I won't go into detail. Suffice it to say that he had one book about as thick as that. We got the copy at Yale. Albus offered him, when it was done, 200 copies free of charge. He said, "I can accept them only if you will also give me a horse." Then he was invited to go to Rome, and now he was received with great deference, even by cardinals, for he brought out several publications already and was getting a reputation. He was invited to stay in Rome. But at that moment, a letter came from England, from his old friend, Lord Mountjoy, saying, "Come back to England. The age of gold has dawned. Our glorious Prince Henry has become Henry VIII. You can't imagine the enthusiasm for Henry VIII at the beginning of his reign. A young man, handsome, fine tennis player, able to talk Latin, write Latin, he's written in Latin itself with Erasmus. Studied theology, was able to reply to Luther later on. All of the young men of learning looked with intense enthusiasm to this prince, for they thought that he would favor all of their enterprises. Come back to England, the golden age has dawned. The prince wants you, he's written you. Archbishop Warren will give you a living in England, come back. Erasmus started back on horseback, of course. We're taking about 3 weeks. There are advantages in that mode of travel and his chance to think. And it's not quite so hard to adjust to the time change. Incidentally, you know, they had no Greenwich then. Every town had its own time. And you might shift an hour from one town to its own immediate environs, and then on again. Well, arriving in England, he stayed in the home of Thomas More for a while, and there, resting up from his journey, he put down a little fantasy which he'd been contemplating on the way. He dedicated it to More and called it the Praise of More, Encomium Moriae. Well, now, Moria in Greek means foolishness. So it's a pun, the Praise of More and the Praise of Folly. In this little skit of a dame, Folly, and Captain Bells, comes to the rostrum to give a lecture. She begins by praising herself. She said, "I am responsible for the continuance of the human race. Were it for me, it would die out. For if people stop to consider how much trouble it is to have a baby, and if they ever have one, they'd never have another. But they don't consider it, and I fully carry them along. So I'm responsible for the human race. I'm responsible for all great enterprises. If people sat down and counted the cost, they'd never start anything. But they don't. They plunge. And all great things thus come to pass. She's spontaneity, recklessness, a failure to be inhibited by fears of what may happen. She is the absence of that brutal candor which wrecks human relations. If a man thinks that his ugly wife is a Penelope, will he not get along with her better than if he is disillusioned? A little humbug is the lubricant of life." But then Folly suddenly becomes downright wickedness. Plain foolishness. The folly of a nobleman who wouldn't think of being a butcher but doesn't mind carving up a stag on the field of chase. The folly of a merchant who will go to the ends of the earth risking his life to bring home some new spices or jewels. The folly of a ruler who is not content with the territory he already has and ready to rule it well, but instead is always trying to advance his border. The folly of a friar who wears a cowl so filthy that a ship's captain would put it on in a storm and thinks that coming up in this smelly rag, he'll get a reward from the Lord Jesus. The folly of a pope who, if he remembered the meaning of pope, papa, father, would not be fighting for the position. The folly of a scholar who ruins his health and his eyes poring over old manuscripts like that Erasmus. Well, now where are we? Does he really mean that scholarship is just as foolish as the behavior of the nobleman and the merchant and the prince and the friar and the pope? Or is he throwing out an insult toward those whose gorge is rising? But at any rate, Folly shifts her meaning again at this point, and folly suddenly becomes the foolishness of God, who chooses the weak things of the world to confound the mighty. The foolishness of the cross, a stumbling block to the Jew, a laughing stock to the Gentile. And then the folly of the seer, the mystic, the poet, who is wrapped beyond all the things of sense and carried an ecstasy into the . He ends up just like the dagger of the Christian soldier, with the mystical experience. Now, what does it all mean, this little gay bit of jeu d'esprit? I think it is really an ironic version of the contempt of the world. For in another tract, he says, gives a whole list of worldly things that are to be held in contempt, family and politics and scholarship. But then says, shall we not then participate in these? No, not that. We shall participate in family life, in government, in scholarship, but with an inner detachment, being in but not of, remembering that we are citizens of another city, moving to a city that has foundations whose builder and maker is God. Such is the spirit that comes through in the dagger of the Christian soldier and the phrase of folly. He stayed in England then, quietly studying, working on his Greek for 2 years, and then in 1511, suddenly his world collapsed. For that glorious Prince Henry VIII went to war on behalf of Pope Julius. Now it came about in this way, that Julius, having taken Bologna, attacked Ferrara and then Venice. Then France came in to help Venice. And then England came in to embarrass France. And by this lineup, Henry was supporting Pope Julius. And the friends of Erasmus had their money taken away from them from the war, and they couldn't support him any longer. He was always supported by friends for his scholarly work. So deeply grieved in spirit, he had to leave England, went back to the Low Countries, lived there in extreme poverty for some years, and in 1513, Pope Julius died. And then there came on a little anonymous skit entitled, Pope Julius Excluded from Heaven. In this dialogue, the Pope arrives at the gate of heaven with a little companion, and a discussion follows. They make use of the ideal method in modern education. It's a dialogue between the Pope and St. Peter. Though Peter does not use the listening method exactly. The Pope is in armor. And on his breastplate, he has the letters PM. He comes up to the gate, gets out the key. Companion said, maybe you got the wrong key. No, he said, it's the key of power. It used to work on earth. Peter hears the rattle and looks over the gate and says, what a stench. Who are you? He said, can't you read? P.M. Pestis Maxima, a big pest. Pontifex Maximus, who are you to talk to me? I am a Ligurian Italian. You're a Jew. Well, why should you care to what country you belong? I want my country to have the credit of me. Well, what have you done that's so creditable? I captured Bologna. Oh? Well, now, Bentivoglio, the ruler, was he a tyrant? Was he a heretic? No. Well, what then?
I wanted Bologna for my son.
Popes with wives and sons?
You don't understand. Sons, not wives.
Well, tell me again, what have you done that I should let you in?
I've made the papacy magnificent. You should see our processions. Dishes steaming, horses prancing, boys dancing, bugles blowing. It's magnificent, and I carry them off on the shoulders of my soldiers. It's superb.
Never had anything like that in my day.
Well, the job wasn't worth having in your day.
In my day, we had imprisonments, scourgings, shipwrecks, beheadings, crucifixion. And by suffering, we conquered.
And you wait till next year till more of my soldiers die and come up here and we'll knock your gates down.
Did Erasmus write that? He did not say, I did not write it. He said, in effect, how would anybody think I would do so?
Thomas More that there was a manuscript in Erasmus' own hand. Now, of course, he could have copied it. But More undertook to defend him and said, there are all these reasons why it isn't likely that he would write it. But suppose he did. Now, would More, who knew the circumstances, ever have supposed that he did if he knew quite definitely that he did not? Then there's another point. There's a poem that's even more stinging. It draws a comparison between Julius Caesar and Pope Julius to the disadvantage of the Pope, and says there's only one point lacking, and that is another Brutus. Now, there was long doubt as to whether Erasmus wrote that, but about 2 years ago, it turned up inside the flyleaf of one of his books in his own handwriting. But there is a puzzle. One of the early editions of the Julius Exclusus has the initials F.A., Faustus Angelinus, that Italian that gave Blake, to whom he had written that letter. So some think that Fausto wrote it. Personally, I think there may have been collaboration, because there's a lot of detail in it about Julius and France that Fausto would have known better than Erasmus, and they were together in 1511. But the style, the form, the conclusion, the way of the cross at the end, just as you have it in the Praise of Folly, all of that seems to me distinctly Erasmian. But it illustrates part of the technique of revolution. The use of anonymous pamphlets is a pretty dangerous trick, because if you're once suspected of one, you may get suspected of half a dozen that you certainly didn't write. And that happened to Erasmus. Well, then he brought out quite a number of serious works on politics, on the education of the Christian prince, a magnificent plea for peace. Peace goes up and down the world and laments that she's everywhere rejected. It has become one of the classics of the peace literature. I'd be glad to give you an analysis of that, but I think it would take a little too long this morning. But of course, I'll move on to his most enduring contribution, and that was his edition, for the first time in history, of the New Testament in Greek, the original tongue in print. The president is said to have said that landing on the moon was the most significant thing that has happened since God created the universe. But I think I put in the printing of the New Testament. We have a copy of it in the Yale Library, 1516. It was very significant because it meant now that every scholar could have a copy. Now, the text was not the best, because Erasmus had only 5 manuscripts and none older than the 11th century. He kept finding more and brought out 5 editions during his lifetime. We've got them all. He knew the deficiencies of his work, but still, to get it done at all was very important. And still more important was the way in which he called attention to problems. First of all, that you can't be so certain with regard to the text. He pointed out that Mark's gospel, after verse 16 in the last chapter, that whole section on the resurrection is lacking in early manuscripts. He pointed out that the section on the woman taken in adultery appears in different places in John's gospel, in different manuscripts, and in some not at all, and the Christians didn't know it. He put in these passages, but in his notes he called attention to this. He left out, for thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory, in the Lord's Prayer. He said it's not in the manuscripts. And he suspected that it crept in through the liturgy. Well, that's the common opinion today. No reason why we shouldn't use it. But it's not in the earliest manuscripts. And of course the Catholics haven't used it. They followed the manuscripts at that point. He left out, there are 3 in heaven that witness, the Father, the Spirit, and the Son. He was accused of denying the Trinity. He said, I don't deny the Trinity. I say that verse isn't here. And he couldn't find it in any manuscript. The verse, there are 3 on earth that witness, the Spirit, the water, and the blood, is genuine. But the other half, about the 3 witnesses in heaven, he couldn't find. He said, if you'll find it in any Greek manuscript, I'll put it back in the next edition.
They found one, manufactured for the purpose, as he suspected, and as we now know, and he put it back. Well, did that mean he just gave in out of cowardice? His argument was this. It's not in St. Cyril in Greek in the East. It's not in Bede in the West. But it is in the Latin translation by St. Jerome, the Vulgate, made in the 4th century. Now, Jerome certainly would not have made it up. It must have been in the Greek that he had in front of him. Consequently, there must have been a discrepancy in the manuscripts way back in the 4th century. And if that is so, how am I to decide? What he did not know was that it does not appear in the manuscripts of the Latin translation of St. Jerome until the 8th century. So you can't use a translation to check a text unless you've got the right text of the translation. Well, now what happened was that Luther used the edition of 1519 that didn't have it, so it didn't go into the German. But Tyndale and the English used the edition of 1522, which did have it. So it went right down through the King James and the American Revised. On the Catholic side, Pope Leo XIII pronounced it genuine, but since then, a committee of Catholic scholars has pronounced it spurious, and the RSV leaves it out altogether. So all of this brought attention to the problems of the text. And then he brought out a new Latin translation directly from the Greek, differing in many respects from the Vulgate. For example, the Vulgate has, "And Jesus came saying, do penance, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." He translated it, "He penitent," and then simply, "Repent." And Luther picked that up at once with reference to the sacrament of penance. Then Erasmus brought out paraphrases of the whole of the New Testament, namely a reworking in simple language and some amplification of the whole gospel story. In England, there was a requirement that a copy of that, an English translation, should be in every English church under Edward VI. We have copies at Yale. I'll give you only one example of the way in which Erasmus handles these themes. Take the prodigal son. And when he came to himself, he said, "I will go to my father and say, Father, I have sinned before heaven and before thee, and am no longer worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thine hired servants." And he arose. And while he was a long way off, his father saw him. The one who had the greater love did first espy the other, and the father ran, and the boy began his little speech. But the father kissed him and threw his arms about his neck and called for the ring and the robe and the fatted calf. Now that father is gone. The year now was 1516. Erasmus was at the peak of his popularity. Kings and counselors and bishops and universities and cities were inviting him to come and settle in their midst. England and France and Ferdinand in Vienna and Ximenes in Spain. And the next year, Luther posted his theses. Erasmus sent a copy to Thomas More. He wrote to a friend and said, "I don't see much that's wrong with it. Unless he's a little too tart on purgatory, because Luther said the Pope has no jurisdiction over purgatory, and if he does, he should empty the place free of charge." When the heat was put on Luther, Erasmus wrote to Frederick the Wise and said he's a good man, he should be reasoned with and convinced. Instead, people cry to the stake, to the stake. Your responsibility as a Christian prince is to see to it that he has a fair hearing. That's what Frederick did. It was Erasmus who pointed it out to him. When Erasmus was, in June of 1520, put under the tentative ban, he was given 60 days in which to submit. Erasmus said, "I don't believe the Pope wrote it." There's a new Pope now, it was Leo. He wouldn't do a thing like that. And when it was obvious that he had, Erasmus said he was very badly informed. The bull actually didn't start to tick on the 60 days until delivered. They didn't reach Luther until October 10th, that gave him until December the 10th. In that summer, he put out a number of very radical tracts. I'll mention only the one on the sacraments, in which he denied transubstantiation and yet believed in a real physical presence. Well, if there's no change in the substance of bread and wine, how can there be a real physical presence? Luther said, because spirit and flesh are not separate, and the body of Christ is everywhere. Well, if it's everywhere, what's special about this? Simply that because of our limitations, God has decreed certain modes of self-disclosure. One is the preaching of the word. The other is the administration of the sacrament. And when the priest says, "This is my body," no miracle takes place. There's not a change in the elements. But our eyes are open, and we behold him where he is. Erasmus said, the church says there's transubstantiation. All right, I believe there's transubstantiation. But remember, that no matter what happens to the elements, they won't do you a bit of good unless you commune with Christ in your heart. Now, Erasmus will admit a physical presence and miracle, if the church has said so, and yet denudes it of all significance by spiritualizing. It's only the inner communion that makes any difference. Then, when December the 10th came and Luther burned the Pope's bull, Erasmus said, "Now you didn't need to do that." When Luther was put under the ban on the Diet of Worms, Erasmus said, "This is perfectly outrageous." Well, now he was at this time back and living in the Netherlands, and here it was that the persecution of the Lutherans began, because the emperor was the local ruler there and could start him without asking any other ruler. And the man who was sent by the Pope to enforce the edict against the Lutherans in the Netherlands was Jerome Aleander, that brilliant young Italian with whom Erasmus had roomed in Venice. And he said, "The way to handle this is to burn half a dozen Lutherans." Erasmus and Aleander had a conference, and it was cool. Then who should arrive and have an interview with Erasmus but a man named Hutten, H-U-T-T-E-N, an ardent German nationalist who wanted to create Germany into a consolidated national state like England, France, and Spain. The way to do it would be to convert the Holy Roman Empire into a German national state. The emperor should head it up. But this could never be done without breaking the political power of the church in Germany, because the bishops were princes. Therefore, there must be a war on the papists. And he came to Erasmus to get a letter of introduction to the emperor to urge him to start the war against the Pope. Oh, Erasmus thought he was a joke at first. One trouble with him was that people didn't know when he was joking, and he didn't know when they were serious. But when he found that Hooten meant it, he was utterly aghast. He won't have anything to do with Aleander and burning the Lutherans. He won't have anything to do with the Lutheran and the attack on the Pope. And he went to church, and he heard one minister say, "If I could get my teeth into the gullet of Martin Luther, I would not hesitate to go with bloody mouth and partake of the body of our Lord." This is too much, said Erasmus. He decided to leave the Netherlands, as he said, to avoid being turned into a carnifex, a butcher, to avoid having to line up with the inquisitors. And he went to Basel and stayed there for the next 7 years of his life. And no sooner did he get there than there was a new pope, a Dutchman, an old friend of Erasmus, who invited him to Rome. He said, "If I come to Rome, the Lutherans won't reap me. If I stay in Basel, I can mediate. I'm sorry, I'm not coming to Rome." Then who should turn up in Basel but Hutten? He did not get the emperor to start a war against the papists, but he did enlist the head of a body of mercenary troops, and they attacked the Archbishop of Trier, and they were beaten, and Houghton, as a refugee, turned up in Basel and wanted to see Erasmus. And Erasmus sent him some money secretly, but he wouldn't have a public interview, because if he did, he'd close the door to talk with the Catholics. He wouldn't go to Rome, but close the door to the Lutherans. He wouldn't talk to Houghton, close the door to the Catholics. And then Houghton came up with a blast. "I'm stupefied and shaken to know what's happened to you, who used to join with us to devote the Pope, inveigh against the Roman crimes, detest the bulls of indulgence, ban ceremonies, expel courtiers, execrate the decretals. You who denounce the universal hypocrisy, you turn around and butter the Pope. You say that we are stirring up hate, dissension, and wars. How else can the gospel prevail? Lift up your voice, cry out. You say Luther throws the apple of discord. Doesn't anybody throw the apple of discord who proclaims the gospel? You said that if Luther goes under, evangelical truth and liberty will suffer a great loss. How can you then oppose? I would never have thought this of you. I would have sworn you would stand to your post. I believed you would be unshakable for truth. I grieve over your defection." Erasmus replied, "How far do you think I'd get? If I asked a bad pope to give a living to a good priest and started out, 'Impious Antichrist, extinguisher of the gospel, oppressor of liberty, I beg you to give this man a benefice.' I do not deny that I seek peace wherever possible. I believe in listening to both sides with open ears. I love liberty. I cannot serve any faction. I have said that all of Luther's teaching cannot be suppressed without suppressing the gospel. But because I favored Luther at first, I don't see that I'm called upon to approve everything that he's said since. I have never called Luther a heretic. He never did. I have complained of dissension and tumult. And at the same time, I have always deplored tyranny and vice in the church. Let us not devour each other like fish. Why upset the whole world over paradoxes? The world is full of rage, hate, and wars. What will the end of it be if we employ only bulls and the stake? It's no great feat to burn a little man. It's a great achievement to persuade him." But now the pressures were being put on Erasmus to come out against Luther. It was being made plain to him that he couldn't stay in the Catholic Church, and he wanted to, unless he dissociated himself from Luther. Henry VIII, Francis, various other people would keep after him. He wrote to Zwingli and said, "Either I'll not write against Luther, or what I write won't suit him." Then a more radical party began to arise in Basel, who wanted to give up the images, reduce the Lord's Supper to a memorial, get rid of the organs, get rid of all of the food and fast regulations, and some of them ate pork on Good Friday. Then the town council asked Erasmus for his opinion. "What do you think about the food laws? What do you think about clerical marriage? Some of them are getting married. What do you think about saint worship? They were giving that up." Erasmus said, "With regard to saint worship, I think if some woman has a daughter named Barbara, she gets the Pope to make a day for Barbara, St. Barbara, and if it falls in harvest time, a peasant can't bring in the crop on which his family depends. And as for the dietary regulations, if the Pope decrees that you can eat only fish in a country where they don't have fish, he's decreeing a famine." "And what do you think of the marriage of the clergy?" "I don't say that they should all be married, but I say it would be a lot better that some of them were married than their sons should be brought up without their fathers." And all this while they're battering at him to come out against Luther. Well, finally he was resolved that he'd have to say something. And he said, "Luther is not a heretic, but still I do disagree with him on something. It is the freedom of the will." Well, now at that point I think they misunderstood each other. Erasmus thought that Luther thought that man is just a law. And Luther thought that Erasmus thought that man could earn his salvation, he's so good. Well, both of them agreed that men can do all of the ordinary acts of life, but that man's nature is such that he'll never be perfect. He'll fall down somewhere, you can't tell where. Therefore, no man has a claim on the forgiveness of God. This is a sheer act of God's grace, appropriated by man through faith. I agree with Luther that we are saved by faith and faith alone, sola fide. But when it comes to predestination, if God has chosen some men before they're born for eternal bliss and others for eternal woe, he's a tyrant. You needn't think, said Luther, that you're the first man ever to be troubled by this more than once I've been cast down to the very abyss of desperation. But who are you to measure God by your standards of morality? The question of omnipotence. Luther didn't say that God is a tyrant. He said we don't see how he is not. But in the meantime, you are not to judge him by your standards, to which Erasmus would say, well, these are the standards of the gospel. And shall we undercut Christian morality by saying God can do anything? Luther said, let God be God. And Erasmus said, let God be good. But anyway, he said, how do you know? Out of the Bible, said Luther. God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Oh, no, he didn't. He just gave him a chance to show how hard it was. Well, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. Well, that's because he saw how they'd turn out. Well, in other words, the Bible, he said, isn't so clear. Most of the early church fathers actually interpreted these passages the way Erasmus did, down to the time of Augustine. And said Erasmus, with regard to that which is not clearly stated in Scripture, I am a skeptic. And I would rather compromise on 10 ambiguous points than disrupt the unity of Christendom. Yes, you are a skeptic, said Luther, a mocking, railing, Lucianic skeptic. And you, with your peace-loving theology, you don't care about the truth. Suppose the world does go to smash, God can make another one. Well, at that point, the fruitful dialogue was discontinued. But it's interesting that Erasmus and Melanchthon never ceased to correspond. And when Melanchthon was near Basel and thought of coming to see Erasmus, he didn't do it for fear he would embarrass him. Erasmus, Melanchthon was sensitive, his Hooten was not. And Erasmus found out about it and he said, I wish you'd come. Well, the bell is gone. I'll summarize in just two or three words, namely, that at that point the radicals took over in Basel. They swept up to the cathedral, smashed all of the images, and in the morning, the place in front of the cathedral was strewn with arms, legs, torsos, wood, stone, all the treasures of the piety of the ages. And it was decreed that everyone must go to the Lord's table, interpreted merely as a memorial, that the Mass should not be celebrated in any church of Basel, that images and music must go, and anyone who would not submit must leave Basel. Very well, said Erasmus, I go. He went to Freiburg in Breisgau, was there 5 years, but the news was disquieting. Word came that in France, Berquin had been burned at the stake. His offense, he had translated Erasmus. After 5 years, Basel modified a little, and Erasmus came back. But the news was still disquieting. That glorious Prince Henry had been responsible for the execution of Cardinal Fisher and Thomas More. Thomas More, more than the very heart of me, half of me. England has never known them like and never will again. The lights were going out, Catholics burning, Protestants beheading, and all the gentleness of Christ forgotten in the turmoil of religious strife. The last thing Erasmus wrote was on preparation for death. He said, there are those whose bones are buried beneath the altar and who have had all of the external rites of the church, whose souls are in hell. And there are those who have had none of the external rites of the church, whose spirits are among the saints. When the end came for himself, he was heard first murmuring in Latin, Miserere mihi Domini, misericordia, miserere mihi. But then in his native language, Dutch, Lieve God, dear God. The lights had gone out, but he didn't know that there were 7,000 who had not bowed the knee to Baal. He did not know that his program of moderation and mediation would eventually be resumed. He did not realize that Melanchthon would carry on his program of education, but neither did he see that the polarization would increase so that by the 1560s in Rome, his followers were being burned. And in Scotland, in that very same period, John Knox was saying that a single reception of the mass is worse than a cup of poison. There came increasing polarization, and then a very slow rapprochement. The cheerful thing about it all is that there has been a rapprochement, and the distressing thing that it took so long. And God grant that we may make greater speed with the problems of our time.